This is Akshat Gupta, producer on Hereabouts, with our new back-to-school episode. Whether you're a new or returning student at Indiana University, or a Bloomington native lamenting as the relative calm of the summer ends, we are all experiencing the hustle and bustle of back-to-school as students return to Bloomington for the fall. This month, we thought a bit of reflection is in order. As I watched hundreds of students walk across our beautiful campus, I couldn't help but be reminded of those who don't have that opportunity for education, or those from whom the opportunity has been stolen. I was reminded of my discussion with Eric Langowski about Japanese-American incarceration during World War II and about how Japanese students were systematically prohibited from enrolling in some universities across the country, including right here at IU. Eric is a fourth-generation Japanese-American undergraduate student at IU. Actually, he just graduated in May, and he is also a board member of the Hoosier chapter of the Japanese-American Citizens League. During his senior year, Eric decided to research IU's World War II-era ban on admitting Japanese-American students. In part one of my interview, Eric told us about Japanese-American incarceration during the war, including the incarceration of his own grandmother. You can hear that again on WFHB.org. Today, we'll hear the second half of my interview with Eric about the enrollment policy at Indiana University and revisit this troubled chapter of IU's history.
For WFHB in Bloomington, this is Hereabouts,
a collaboration with the IU Asian Culture Center.
So that brings us to discrimination in Indiana University's history, which you had researched as part of this archival work. So what was the first documented case of this which you learned about?
Yeah, so I saw a blog post on the IU Bicentennial's website. And once I saw that, I was kind of flabbergasted. How did I never hear about this history? Why was this history never featured or told or anything like that? And I use history with kind of, I call it Nisei wartime education, is one of exclusion. So IU closed the gates. They refused to educate from May of 1942 to September of 1945 after the war ended. And that kind of general framework and everything that goes in that related to, we all know that Bloomington is in southern Indiana, and southern Indiana is close to the South. And throughout,
so you can get, yeah.
Yeah, and throughout the early American history up until very recently, you see kind of the specter of slavery and racism and kind of anti-black sentiment being institutionalized. And Bloomington was segregated through the end of the war. Kind of the veterans being of any race helped desegregate Bloomington, as with many places. And this history with race being a very complicated one. And it's one where IU was so majority white, I want to say more than 95% through 1970 was the student body. You see kind of this very university which isn't equipped to deal with the question which is presented to it by the government in 1942, do you want to educate Japanese Americans? Mm-hmm. These students are basically refugees. Many of them were enrolled at the time of Pearl Harbor already in West Coast institutions, but based on their current status of incarceration, there's kind of this entirely different framework of the college admittance process. And within IU's specific decision-making process, you see the question of in May 1942 come up about German and Italian refugee students and Japanese-American students. Right. And at the time, IU decides actually that not only do we want to take German and Italian refugees, but we'll give them scholarships, but we don't want to take any Japanese Americans.
I'm Akshat Gupta in discussion with Eric Langowski. We'll be right back after we hear Right Now by Amber Liu.
This is just crazy. Maybe it's too late now. This time around, no will do I ever cross your mind. Baby, can you hear me? Remember the times you used to lay me in your arms? Can you love me once again? Oh no, no, cause now I know
it ain't your fault.
Apologies, baby, just come on back to me, back to me, back to me. Cause I know I need you now, but I don't know about you. Cause you got me, baby, I'm just trying to play it cool.
I need you right now,
right now,
right now,
right now. Cause baby, don't you know I need you here? It's getting hard to breathe. Now I'm stuck here running circles, still I can't you see?
I've been waiting here for you. You know I'm sorry, my one and only. I promise that I'll do the best I can, and I can hide away all the things I feel, baby.
I
know it ain't your fault, yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
I've been so wrong.
Is it too late for apologies, baby? Just come on back to me, back to me, back to me.
Easier erasing all the memories of you
and all the things I try to do, cause nowhere only leads to you.
Try just to break all the holes that we made.
I feel it so empty that we can't replace.
Cause over again and again,
why do you still keep playing?
That was Right Now by Amber Liu. Now more of my discussion with Eric Langowski. So what was the justification that you found in your research that administrators had for enrolling, on the one hand, German and Italian students and not including or enrolling Japanese students?
Yeah, Japanese American students. Yeah. It's complicated because there were many reasons that Japanese Americans were discriminated against in World War II. In the Board of Trustees meeting itself, where they announced the policy, you see Ora Wildermuth, the president of the Board of Trustees, express racist sentiments. He talks about how Japanese Americans are different racially, and he doesn't think they belong or can assimilate the same way that maybe Germans or Italians could.
And I want to emphasize, this is a direct quote. You're not paraphrasing.
Yeah, the specific quote is, okay. As I see it, there's a difference in Japanese and German or Italians. They are Aryans and can be assimilated, but the Japanese can't. They are different racially. I can't believe that any Japanese, no matter where he was born, is anything but a Japanese.
And this is the same Wildermuth after whom there are a few buildings on campus named. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. I mean, Wildermuth has also done, he also has some controversial statements on segregation and white and black relations, which have led to some attempts to rename the building, specifically in 2008.
So this was, to what extent would you say this was deliberate, an official university policy, or was it because of some lone decentralized administrators? Because I think somebody can easily see how, oh, somebody's on the admissions committee and they've just willfully neglected these types of applicants, right? But you're saying it was much more direct result of decisions made at Board of Trustees meetings.
Yeah, no, it was a specific policy, and that actually was the reason the ban went on so long. You see, IU administrators later in the war question and kind of think, we don't have any good reason to not accept Japanese Americans, but the only thing that could change the policy was another Board of Trustees meeting. So the trustees discussed whether or not they wanted to make it an implicit policy. They said, if we just reject these four Japanese Americans, which they had four applicants before them in May of 1942, maybe everyone will just get the idea that we don't want them here, then we don't have to worry about making a specific ban or not. We just kind of, like the trustees say, we don't want these four, and then everyone kind of takes out of that, we don't want any of them. So it was a very explicit thing, and the policy was basically, we know Jap will be admitted to Indiana University is what it said explicitly. So there's not really any other way to put that.
Are there any specific cases that come to mind of the dozens or so that you must have researched?
Yeah, so the history is really interesting. You have a primarily Quaker organization formed called the National Japanese American Student Relocation Council. And within that framework, you see they basically try to act as matchmaker. They contact all the colleges and they ask you, will you take Japanese Americans? If you say yes, they'll send you some. If you say maybe, but we have this problem, they'll try to fix it. And if you say no, they'll basically leave you alone throughout the entire war. And IU said no. So IU didn't get any applications from anyone who was incarcerated from mid-1942 to mid-1944, basically the majority of the war. But some did apply to IU, mostly kind of these students that already lived in Midwest towns who had some connection to Southern Indiana or wanted to be in Indiana to be closer to their family. And in October of 1943, there's one case, which is the best one. And her name is Sumike Ito. And she lived in Indianapolis at the time. She worked for kind of the equivalent of the IU hospital system and wanted to get more nursing training to help the war effort. And her sister also was going to college in Southern Indiana. So she wanted to be kind of specifically at IU's nursing school to be close to her sister at the time. And you see the dean of women at the time write her back and say, basically, you wrote a really nice letter and you're a great person, but we can't take you. And kind of within that history and that denial, you see some backlash. People write the university and the administrators write each other and they say, how can we employ this person, but we can't take her as a student? They talk about how taking some administrators while defending the policy to a concerned citizen that we would have to turn away Indiana girls if we admit her. And Sumike did live in Indiana. Maybe were talking about something else. But yeah, you kind of see this huge, you kind of see the, within the context of the bureaucracy of IU and what you would like to think of as kind of algorithmic or impartial decisions, that you see racism and this policy of Japanese Americans being different, Japanese Americans being criminalized nationally, being incarcerated, being reflected in IU's admission policies at the time.
This is Akshat Gupta in discussion with Eric Langowski. We'll return in a moment after we listen to On My Own with Amber Liu.
It's okay, it's okay. I'll lie and say it's okay. So far I've gone to get to you. It's okay, it's okay. You see through my heart and face. Try to see the light through the rain, hoping that nothing's gone. But still is running thin. I know I'm losing my senses. I pray each and every day for me to stay awake, 'cause I'm on my own. Where are you? It's too late, it's too late. It's just too late. Won't believe I came too late. The bells rung me out. Down, I'm done for good. I'm done for good. Though there's no way, but still I hold on. This mask is running thin. I know I'm losing my senses. I pray each and every day for me to stay awake, 'cause I'm on my own. But still I hold on. senses. Pray each and every day for me to stay awake, 'cause I'm on my own. Where are you?
You were just listening to On My Own by Amber Lou. Now back to my interview with Eric Langowski. So the ban was revoked in 1945, just after the war ended, 22 days after Japan surrendered. So to what extent did discriminatory policies continue despite the ban being revoked?
Yeah, that's a part of the history that when I first went over the archives, I didn't really find too much about. But now that I've kind of gone through a lot more, I've actually been able to find the first students that IU admitted that were Japanese Americans after the war. And in many ways, and maybe a little surprisingly, they're good stories. You have a veteran be admitted in 1946. He finished his degree in 1 year and went to Yale Law School. And then you even have what we would call an international student today, but someone who was born in Japan but had lived in the United States throughout most of the war, be admitted in 1947. So that is kind of when you see maybe a larger shift, where instead of having post-war anti-Japanese sentiment, you see kind of the issues that led into the civil rights movement, anti-blackness, and issues like that being more prominent. But after the war, it definitely seems to be that IU began to treat Japanese Americans like any other applicant, especially because now Japanese Americans were veterans. You see these Japanese American veterans being treated like any other veteran. And I think that kind of switch from before they were somehow wrong, they would somehow cause problems or race riots, spy on us, to, oh, here they fit in and there's no problems at all 2 years later. That seems to cast doubt upon the original arguments for why we couldn't take Japanese Americans during the war.
So I think you guys have delivered a petition to IU to sort of acknowledge this history and formally apologize. And there are other universities that have apologized already. Is that right?
That is correct. So it's a little complicated, but many West Coast universities, including the entire University of California system, have actually issued retroactive diplomas to any student that was forced to withdraw because of incarceration. And then
purely symbolic gesture, of course, but probably means a lot to the families.
Yeah, it means a lot to the families. And it, in some ways, it's a reclamation of a space that which was denied to them. There's a great book actually written by an IU professor. It's called The Afterlife of Nikkei Wartime Incarceration. And she talks about retroactive diplomas in that mm-hmm. book. But yeah, you have that as the main kind of examples of an apology. UCLA denied transcripts to students that were incarcerated, so you couldn't transfer. And you kind of see an extra apology from them, although some wish it went farther. And you see kind of Midwestern universities, you only see them really telling the history when they have a history of inclusion. So Oberlin College and Earlham College both kind of have really great histories of inclusion. They took a lot of Japanese Americans, and they frequently tell the history or have exhibits about it on their campuses. But when you come to a university like IU, where the history is only of exclusion, we don't have the Japanese American alumni. We don't have the story. We don't kind of have a good story. We don't have a story where we can point at someone and say, we educated you throughout the war. All of your rights and like ability to be an American was stripped from you. We gave some back to you. That's the story that you can tell if you took Japanese Americans during the war. And IU doesn't have that story. So you see kind of that means that in general, that if you don't have a good story, you're not going to try to tell it. But fortunately, kind of as a result of that petition, I'm working with the university historian to tell the history. And it's going to be an important chapter of IU's history, the one that hasn't been there hasn't been a lot of voice given to this history, the university doesn't look good in this history.
This is Akshat Gupta speaking with Eric Langowski. We'll be right back after Lifeline by Amber Lou.
Searching for a lifeline, anything to grab onto. Hopes of someone out there listening, but you just stood. You said time.
That was Lifeline by Amber Liu. Let's now conclude our discussion with Eric Langowski. To what extent, I'm wondering, did you have resistance or pushback from other researchers or university historians, librarians, maybe even administrators for this kind of work that you were doing? And to what extent were they very cooperative or, you know, helping things along?
Yeah, that's a good question. Luckily, the archivists and the historians in the university, there is one university historian, and that's who I work with. So not trying to talk about him specifically, but kind of historians in general. And you see that they basically were the only reason that I was able to do this research. So they've gone through previously and done a lot of work in the archives. You have this kind of rare decision where a folder will be created in the archives just about a particular topic if it's of particular importance, and there's a folder just about Japanese students, and that was kind of the start of my research, and that really helped me get going. And then obviously the university is helping me write this work and is supporting me through that. So, and I think that, I mean, it's really tough because in many ways, what happened was the opposite of what a university is supposed to do. A university refused to educate and did not educate. And I think the consequences and the results of that, the legacy of that, is really complicated. And I think that means that first approached the administration and first worked with them. I think the history was really hard to understand. I basically came up and said, IU banned 10 people from being admitted. IU should apologize. Yeah. But I think that there's a lot more to the history than that. And I've been able to find a lot more of that. But I mean, I would only say that it's important that the administrators that I hopefully will continue to work with are willing to read my research and to think about critically and educate themselves on this issue, just because it's really complicated. Unless you really think about what does it mean for the university to ban a class of people based only on their race, and then what happens after that? They're refused education. They remain incarcerated because college was the ticket out for young Nisei. And everything like that. You participate in the government-sponsored racism and incarceration. And that's basically, in so many ways, the opposite of what universities do. They educate, they break down barriers, they bring people together. So it kind of within the context of that mission being perverted in many ways, in nativism or racism, there's just a lot to unpack. And I've kind of been doing this for I've been doing this since January now, and I think I'm finally starting to get it. But so it's not, I don't think, I mean, the historians and the archivists have definitely worked with me so closely. Right. The administration, I just hope that I can help the administration understand the issues more fully.
So what is the status right now of your research and also the petition that you talked about?
Yeah, so kind of what is going to happen now is I'm about to publish a history paper, hopefully in
Majors History.
Yes.
I love it.
I'm about to publish a history paper. It's been a complete mess. I've been really racking my head over some of these concepts and methodologies of writing history. But I'm about to publish that paper, and then kind of the hope after that is there's two things coming up. I mean, one of them is the 20th anniversary of the Asian Culture Center. It's coming up in October.
That's right.
And then the other thing is every February 19th, Japanese Americans across the country run events called Day of Remembrance events. So kind of the two things I'm hoping to do after this paper is done are to do something in conjunction with the 20th anniversary of the ACC, and then also to run a Day of Remembrance event at IU, where I hopefully bring in Oberlin or in Earlham College, one of those universities which took Japanese Americans, and put the two histories side by side and kind of contrast them and really tell the story of IU in a way that you can't. I mean, IU's history is of exclusion, but you can't really tell a history of exclusion and have it be something that people can engage with and something that people can understand unless you somehow bring in some student stories, some personal stories.
Or maybe something in comparison.
Or something in comparison, yeah.
And has IU responded to the petition itself?
It's kind of complicated, but basically the response to the petition was that I needed to do more research. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Okay. So what's next for you? I think you're headed off to graduate school. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm going to Chicago to study data science and public policy, which is some buzzwords there. But basically, I'm hoping to, as a math major, I'm hoping to kind of channel my interest in civil rights and social justice into quantitative methods, which can be used to tell stories of oppression and stories of inclusion.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and for enlightening us both about the history and the research that you've been doing, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Eric Langowski speaking to us about IU's enrollment policy on Japanese American students during and after World War II. You can hear the first half of my discussion with Eric or this episode again on WFHB.org.
You've been listening to Hereabouts.
Hereabouts is produced with the IU Asian Culture Center and broadcast from WFHB in Bloomington. Our theme music is by Eternal Youth.
Tune in to Hereabouts every other week from 5:30 to 6 on Wednesdays right here on WFHB.